Tonight with Jamil Giovanni on the iHeartRadio Canada Talk Network.
Welcome to the show, everybody. And you know, if you are paying attention to what's going on in the world, if you're tuned in to how power is shifting in our society, there's never a dull moment. There's never a dull moment. Every day there's some very interesting story going on reminding us of who's trying to take power and who's losing power in our society. But today was a big one. Today was a big day of bombshell news, and almost nobody in Canadian media is talking about it. And I'm gonna break it down for you. Okay, the New York Post, the fourth biggest newspaper in America, published a story today accusing the Biden family of corruption. The basic idea in their story is that a Ukrainian energy company worked with Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and Joe Biden's son, part of how he made his money in Ukraine, is giving access to rich people to his father. So if you do business with Joe Biden's son, Hunter, if you put him on your board of directors, if you give him money, you will then get to be a friend to his father, the vice president at the time under the Obama administration. And that's how the family made money, abusing their authority and their position in the U.S. government. That's the story. I can't tell you that it's true or not. I am not an expert. I'm just telling you that is what the New York Post said. Now, what happened after that is the interesting part, though. Facebook and Twitter both started to block people from being able to actually share this story online. Literally, if you went, I checked it out myself. If you went on your Twitter account or your Facebook account and tried to share this article by the New York Post, Facebook and Twitter would actually prevent you. You would get a pop-up notification telling you that there's an error and you can't share this. That's literally what happened today. Facebook and Twitter conspired to stop you from sharing information from the fourth largest newspaper in America. And not only that, Twitter actually shut down the account of the New York Post. So the New York Post couldn't even tell you what was happening. And not only that, it gets even worse. If you wanted to send this story in a private message, not even post it on your Facebook page, not even tweet it on your Twitter timeline, you just wanted to say, hey, my friend Joe, my friend Mary, I'm going to send you this link. They would stop you from sending it in a private message. This is the first time in history. I want to repeat this to you. The first time in history that a social media company has cracked down on a legitimate news source. The New York Post was founded by Alexander Hamilton. This is one of the oldest newspapers in the world. And Twitter and Facebook have decided that they're going to censor them because they didn't like what was being posted. Now, Facebook and Twitter will tell you that it is because they are worried that there are lies or mistruths in this article. They want to protect us. So of course, right? They're doing it for us, everybody. They want to protect us from misinformation. That's what they say. They want to protect us from misinformation, which is why they are censoring the fourth biggest newspaper in America. But when did we elect them to make that decision? When did we decide we're going to give Twitter and Facebook that much power? This is something we need to be very careful about, everybody, because it's very clear that they're going to use that power in ways that fit their own political agenda. When misinformation is published about all sorts of other things, the Chinese government has a Twitter account. The Iranian government has a Twitter account. North Korea has a Twitter account. These guys are putting misinformation out every single day. And Twitter doesn't suspend them. Facebook doesn't censor them. Why is it right now, in this moment, less than a month away from the U.S. election, we're supposed to believe all of a sudden Twitter and Facebook are really concerned with misinformation? Do they think we're that stupid? Apparently they do. So even the head of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, he acknowledged that this is messed up. He didn't acknowledge it for real. But he said, our communication around the New York Post article was not great. Blocking URL sharing via direct messages with zero context is not acceptable. That's what he said. And he's right to say it. So even the head of Twitter has acknowledged they did something wild today. Like they crossed a line today in trying to censor information to us, the users of social media. Even if you're not American, they will bring this to Canada too. Don't get the game twisted. Just because they're trying it out in another country, don't sit back and say, this is not our business. If they're going to do this in America, you better be damn sure they're going to do that up here too, whenever they feel like it. If someone might be prime minister who they don't want to be prime minister, watch out. Watch what they might pull on us. So he acknowledged they did something wild today. Senator Josh Hawley, one of the most vocal critics of Twitter in the U.S. Senate, he has responded. He's trying to lead an investigation into why this happened. He thinks they may have broken election law, criminal violation of election law by using their power as social media companies to privilege one political candidate over another. And he's threatening to do an investigation. I hope he's successful. And I don't even say that as someone who really, frankly, cares all that much about Biden or Trump. For me, I'm not a big fan of either one of them, but I do not like people manipulating us. I do not like people censoring us, and I don't like people trying to play with our minds. That's my issue. And so I'm glad to see a U.S. senator stepping up. I would love it if a Canadian politician would say something about this. I would love to see that. Not holding my breath, but I would love to see that. The editor, one of the editors of the New York Post also came out, and this is what he said, and he's using big words, but it's worth thinking about. He said, this is what totalitarianism looks like in our century. It's not men in darkened cells driving screws under the fingernails of dissidents. It's tech dweebs removing from vast swaths of the internet a damaging expose on their preferred candidate. And he went on to say, what happened to us being the New York Post, should alarm every American. Very few people can unaccountably shape what you read. And that, as I said, is not just shouldn't be just disturbing Americans. It should disturb anybody who lives in a democracy. These big tech companies want to be our overlords. The media companies want to be our overlords. There are people accumulating power all around us every day who want to tell us what to think, how to think, what to say, what we can read, what we can listen to, what we can watch. And we should not be just sitting back idly by watching them do this. That is not freedom. That is not democracy. That is not equality. That is not freedom of speech. That is not freedom of expression. These are values we should stand by and fight for. And when we see them being taken from us by these giant tech companies, by these giant media organizations, we got to speak up, everybody. And the fact that you can go on every major Canadian news website right now, and none of them are talking about this. Why is that? Why is that? Why is no one talking about this? Why does no one else seem to see in Canadian media that this is an urgent problem that we should be upset about? That's a question I'm going to leave for you. We'll be right back.
This is Tonight with Jamil Giovanni on the iHeart Radio Canada Talk Network.
Well, top of mind for all of us these days, regardless of where you live across the country, is COVID-19. How are we going to get some semblance of normalcy back? How are we going to get control over this virus? Are we going to continue to be locked down and dealing with the economic and mental health and spiritual consequences of that? All these questions are running through all of our minds. And anytime we see someone who might have an idea that could help us take a step forward in the right direction, it's a thrill to bring them on the show, because I love being able to hear what other people are thinking and how we might arrive to some solutions on this. And that's why I'm very happy to welcome to the show Ashish Anand, founder and CEO of Darwin Labs. Ashish, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jamil. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us, and thank you for the innovative work you do and your company. Tell us, what is Clear 360, and how is it relevant to the challenge that we're all focused on right now, COVID-19?
Thanks, Jamil. Thanks for having me on. So I'm a software entrepreneur from Vancouver. Like you said, I run Darwin Labs. We're a digital health innovation lab, so we create solutions for digital health using cloud, AI, mobile technologies. So Clear 360 is a solution we developed. It's a health safety solution for schools, colleges, and workplaces. And what we're trying to do is bridge the gap between what public health is doing in terms of coming up, you know, doing the research, looking at therapeutics, looking at best practices, looking at what's working around the world and coming up with guidelines, and the behavior that they're trying to elicit in all of us in terms of behavioral change. So we're kind of that middle layer between what public health guidelines are coming out and the behavior that we're wanting to see. The system that we've developed helps achieve that end.
Yes, I mean, for those of us who are not tech entrepreneurs and may not fully grasp what a cloud-based platform accomplishes, let's take a specific challenge we're looking at, like tracking COVID transmission in schools right now. I mean, all of us, whether you have kids or not, we're getting these updates, you know, from our provincial governments across Canada every week, letting us know how many cases they've discovered in our schools. How does Clear 360 help us think that through and respond to that problem?
Sure. So this is really, really topical. I mean, there's over, I think, 1,040 as of today, might even be a little bit more than that, confirmed cases of COVID-19 in schools. I think that's just in Ontario. Across Canada, it's probably a higher number. There's over 580 students, almost 170 staff members. So really, really big challenge as we're trying to keep schools open, enable kids to get better education, enable you know, parents to go to work. What we do is we make the job of people that are in the role of actually implementing these health guidelines, so school administrators, risk and safety officers within schools, school districts, we provide a solution that makes it very easy for them to implement these guidelines. So I'll give you sort of a very specific example. So all of the different public health agencies, and this goes across North America, they're all requiring a daily health check, a daily self-screening, kind of a pre-arrival clearance, if you will. They want you to answer questions like, you know, if you have symptoms, provide details around what symptoms you have, whether you've traveled, whether you've tested positive, whether you've been in contact with someone who may have tested positive. And based on what your answers are, you're either cleared to go into school or not. And if you're not, then you have to self-isolate or quarantine. And in that time, your symptoms have to be monitored just to make sure that they don't worsen. So our solution makes that, either takes it out of the paper and pen and pad and like whatever manual methods schools are using and puts it online. Whether it's the students or the parents, in the case of students that are too young, they use a mobile app, they do daily health checks, and they get either cleared or not cleared. And if they are cleared, then the school knows that everyone that's coming in is symptom-free, has not traveled, and so on. And what that really accomplishes is all of the protocols that the schools are putting in, so for example, distancing and masks and so on, all of those become more effective. Because you're just taking, you're taking out the people that normally would have just, you know, come in if they had symptoms or were high risk, and it makes everything more effective in terms of what the schools are trying to accomplish. So our solution just puts it online, puts it on autopilot, and saves hours and hours of time for school administrators who have to do this manually today.
So, Ashish, how do we get to a point where technologies like what your company is developing are tested and seriously considered by governments? I mean, is there a way for us to kind of get better at integrating our governmental responses to things with the sorts of technologies that are being made available? Are there barriers that are making that difficult?
You're asking a really, really good question. I would say if you look at the countries that are held up as models today, Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, other Asian countries, I wouldn't include China. They are in a separate category. because of just the way they do things based on their governmental system. But a lot of other Asian countries that are held up and they have like single digit cases or just very, very low community spread. If you actually look at what they're doing differently, a big part of it is just the way they use technology. And I don't mean just they as a society. I mean the government institutions, the public health agencies. They're just a lot more open culturally. I think they're just more open to, they're a bit more transparent. They're open to trying things. They're open to innovation. We do have a cultural challenge in North America, which is really odd because we see ourselves as quite a progressive culture, you know, as a Western country. But the reality is that a lot of our government agencies are, you know, they're just the way they're built and the way they're designed. They're not really open to innovation. They're coming around, but it's a very slow process. So I think the way we get there is by, embracing innovation, embracing the idea that you can actually try something on a small scale, see if it works, do more of it. And I think on a societal level as well, we have a responsibility to understand that this is these are extenuating circumstances. We're getting our temperatures checked. We're having to do these screenings. We're, you know, having to wear masks. We're having to stand 6 feet apart. We have to play our role as well, our part in this. And so I think it's a collective. It's both sides, but it does start with public health agencies. I really, really value what they do. But if you actually step back and look at what they're putting out, it's primarily instructions. It's PDF files. They're providing, you know, they're publishing instructions on what we should all be doing. I just think we could, you know, with the technologies that are available, we can do a lot more. We can manage this a lot better. So that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, good on you for taking this challenge on. And, if your technology is able to help us address a piece of this puzzle that we're all trying to figure out right now, I hope people will take a close look at it. For anyone listening who wants to learn more, where can they learn more about Clear 360?
Clear360.com. It's very, very easy to find. We are in the process of rolling this out to a number of different organizations and schools. And what we're finding, and it's a little bit sad for us, is we're getting much better reception in the U.S. than we are in Canada, although we have, we're doing pilots here as well. But we'd love to, we're a Canadian company. We're a proud Canadian company. We'd love to help Canadian organizations more than anyone else. So we'd be happy to help in any way. And, this thing will eventually come to an end. This is our perspective. But we want it to come to an end as fast as possible. And if technology can play a role, then, we'd be delighted. We'd be delighted to see the end of this.
Well said. Thank you for joining the show, Ashish. And anyone who wants to learn more about Clear 360, it's very simple, clear360.com. Well,
thanks,
we will be, yeah, thanks, Ashish. Take care. We'll be back after the break with our Wednesday night Brain Trust panel, where we're going to talk about what has been the ongoing drama over the course of the week, the confirmation hearing of Amy Coney Barrett, who has been nominated by President Donald Trump to replace Judith Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tonight with Jamil Giovanni on the iHeartRadio Canada Talk Network.
We are back, and as we do every Wednesday night, we are going to check in with our Brain Trust panel featuring Ginny Roth, National Practice Lead in Government Relations at Crestview Strategy, and Sean Spear, Fellow in Residence at the Public Policy Forum. Ginny, Sean, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jamil.
Hi, Jamil.
Hey, so I want to start with the ongoing confirmation hearings that are happening in the United States right now with Amy Coney Barrett. It is going to go on for some time, this drama surrounding the U.S. Supreme Court. I believe the vote is expected on October 26th, so we're still some time away from that, right before the U.S. election, and I think it will only get more intense as we go on. However, it has been interesting to note that unlike what happened 2 years ago with Justice Brett Kavanaugh, there has not been really any scandals or big breaking news as it relates to Judge Amy Coney Barrett, which makes me think she must have the cleanest record possible, given there's so much motivation to bring up anything negative about her that someone could possibly find. Ginny, let's start with you. What stood out to you about the confirmation hearing so far?
I mean, first I would say, Jamil, you're right. There has clearly been a strong desire on the part of a lot of people to try to make the media coverage of her. At first, the Republicans' desire to potentially try to appoint her, and now their actual attempts to appoint her through this hearing process and to try to make something negative of it. And, you know, at first it was about the illegitimacy of the process, which I think Mitt Romney sort of fit it best when he spoke to the president, and it being totally reasonable that she would be appointed in the context of an election. And then, you know, there were people stooping to much, I think, more embarrassing lengths. There were people who wanted to point out the fact that she had adopted children from Haiti and somehow cast aspersions on that, which how you can begin to negatively portray someone for having adopted children from places where they couldn't find a home is crazy to me. But it didn't really stick. And now I think Democrats and others who hope not to see her appointed are trying to make something of the hearings. But as you pointed out, she has governed herself admirably. She's very well prepared. She's professional, as you would expect of anyone with her resume and pedigree. And she's also politically wise insofar as she's not taking a lot of bait. Any judge, I think, that's being considered for the Supreme Court needs to show they can't show their hand on the kinds of rulings that they would that would come before them in the Supreme Court, and so she has every right to be a bit circumspect about some of her opinions. And she also has a record that people can look to if they want to understand where she is more likely to fall on the issues. So she's been articulate, she's been prepared, and that means the media coverage has gotten a bit boring, frankly, which is probably good for her.
Yeah, and frankly, I think good for everyone. I mean, we have enough excitement in American political news these days. I think having someone who's boring and competent and seems like she just wants to do her job and do it well, that's a refreshing thing to see. Sean, what stood out to you so far about the confirmation hearing?
I agree with everything that Ginny has said. I think that Judge Barrett has distinguished herself in not just in the confirmation hearings, but over her career as someone with integrity, someone who's credentialed, who's qualified. And I think, you know, notwithstanding the Democrats' aversion to replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was a high-profile liberal on the court, with someone like Judge Barrett with more conservative leanings, I think, as Ginny says, they have to kind of grudgingly concede that she's a qualified and competent appointee to the bench. You know, if I could just make one point, Jamil, I've noticed in a lot of the Canadian commentary a tendency to be a bit self-righteous about the so-called politicization of the U.S. process, a sense that our Supreme Court and our judiciary are somehow non-political, unlike the American system. And I think that's a kind of fundamentally wrong. You know, the extent to which there's a difference, it's not that our system is non-political and theirs is political, it's that our system is deeply monolithic. You know, we have a judiciary and an entire kind of legal ecosystem in Canada, which basically is political, but political in the sense that it is monolithically left-wing. And, you know, what makes the U.S. system so-called political is that there are competing views, as one would expect, on fundamental questions about justice and individual rights and the Constitution. And so You know, if anything, as a Canadian observing the American process playing itself out, I'm sort of envious of the competition of ideas that is reflected in Judge Barrett's confirmation hearings, and something I wish we saw more of in Canada when we're, you know, dealing with issues of fundamental principle. You know, we ought not to be seeing the types of unanimous decisions happening at the Supreme Court. That's not a sign of depoliticization. That's the sign of monolithic and conformist thinking. And I think that we aren't well served by that.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that that's something that stands out about the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think related to that, there's an energy and a passion people have for the U.S. Supreme Court and debating, you know, what its role should be and how a judge should function in a democracy that we don't really have in Canada the same way. Ginny, do you think that's because we don't have the same, I guess, politicization of our court, that we might not have the same passionate debates about what the Supreme Court should be?
Well, I don't think Sean could have put it better. It's not that we don't have to put that. It's not that we don't have the politicization. It's that the sort of center left elites in Canada, corporate elites, political elites, and judiciary elites, have very successfully allowed their shared perspectives to be seen to be the quote unquote neutral or sort of non-political perspective that they all share. And of course, that's not true. And we know that it doesn't necessarily reflect how average Canadians feel. And so we kind of delude ourselves into thinking that. And then every once in a while, you know, a retired Supreme Court justice will weigh in on something that kind of in Canada that kind of crosses the boundary, and we'll all sort of chuckle to ourselves because we know in reality that's how it works. And in Canada, you know, we've had a history of majority governments in many cases that aren't so far off from each other in terms of their ideology and politics, whether they're conservative or liberal. And so this monolithic view actually, I think, transcends the courts and even extends into our politics, or certainly has for the last number of decades. I don't know that that will continue to be true, because I think globally we're experiencing an important moment where a lot of the consensus thinking is coming under question. And the U.S. is just further ahead of us on that. I think they're confronting that. They have historically, they tend to be more individualistic and therefore prioritize political debate in a healthier way. And they're also confronting some of these much deeper challenges about how to confront the issues that our world faces. That Canada, I think we're just not quite there yet, but I'm hopeful we'll get there.
Yeah. Well, we will be back after the break to continue our conversation with Ginny Roth and Sean Spear. And I want to ask them about the religious dimension of how Judge Amy Coney Barrett is being treated and how this story is being covered in the media. We'll be right back.
Listening to the iHeartRadio Canada Talk Network, and this is Tonight with Jamil Giovanni.
We are back with our Wednesday night Brain Trust panel featuring Ginny Roth and Sean Spear, and we're talking about the confirmation hearings concerning Judge Amy Coney Barrett, nominated by President Donald Trump to replace Judith Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court. And one of the most interesting, and depending on your perspective, I suppose, disturbing aspects of this public political drama over the last few weeks has been the way religion is invoked in the debate, and the way that Judge Barrett is treated as though she has some kind of hidden theocratic agenda that she wants to force upon the people of America from the Supreme Court, because she is a Catholic woman and because she is quite passionate and faithful in her engagement with her religion. It bothers me for many reasons, but not the least of which is I don't really think we have the language to talk about this in our society right now. We don't really have an equivalent of Islamophobia, for example, that we would apply to prejudice toward Christians, or an equivalent of anti-Semitism we would apply toward prejudice toward Christians. But there are certainly people exhibiting a very bizarre, deep hatred, I would say, for Christianity and adherence to Christianity. Sean, let's start with you. Do you, you know, see the same thing? Am I overreacting here? What's your take on the way religion is played out in this news story?
No, I think your instinct is right. It's hard to reconcile progressives, you know, who purportedly are committed to pluralism and tolerance, to be trafficking in anti-Catholic bigotry. You know, one gets the sense that the only acceptable bigotry on the left is against Christianity. And I think we've seen that play out both in Judge Barrett's original confirmation when she was appointed to the Seventh Circuit Court, and now regrettably playing out again as she has been nominated to the Supreme Court. I would just say, Jamil, even more regrettably, I don't think the situation would be different here in Canada. In fact, there's even a smaller berth in our public discourse in the public square for people of religious faith to participate in politics and public life. You know, I think, for instance, of Julie Payette, the governor general, who soon after her appointment spoke contemptuously about people of faith in general and Christians in particular. And I think, you know, it's a sad commentary on the political left in Canada and in the United States that pluralism and tolerance seems to have a limit. And that limit applies to people of faith in general and Christians in particular. And as I say, regrettably, we've seen that play out over the past couple of days in the Senate confirmation hearings.
Yeah, Ginny, I mean, I think part of what I see, too, is this suggestion that somehow you cannot be a Catholic and a feminist, or a Christian and a person who believes that women have equal talents and equal rights in society. And I just think it's weird to pin that narrative on a woman who seems to embody the exact opposite, that she is this incredibly talented leader with a phenomenal career and a great resume, and also a Catholic. And so it's almost like she's the counterpoint to the narrative they're trying to force upon her.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what makes it fun to watch. I agree with everything Sean said, and it's shameful, and it's interesting that the critique of her is often expressed as merely describing her religious views, as though that in and of itself is an indictment, without even needing to sort of prove any negative motive or outcome beyond that, which speaks to, it's really one of the few identity groups left that I think is, you know, people have declared open season on still in Canada as well as in the U.S. And yet her circumstances kind of belie a core part of the argument against Christian values, right? There's this view that somehow if you live a Christian life, that stands in opposition to liberal feminist values where women can succeed outside of the household. And she is a sort of shining beacon of how that, in fact, that's not true. Not only that, she has seven children, right? So she, her example actually is almost the most absurd version you could come up with of someone who's managed to create a balanced family life that really values the traditional role of the family, of the parents and children, and having many children, and then going on to have a really, really successful and ambitious career, where she's actually alluded to the fact that her husband has had to take a bit of a step back in his career in moments in order for her to succeed, certainly in this moment. And their family's been very open about that. And that, I think, is really uncomfortable for people who want to criticize her for Christianity, because it kind of proves a counterpoint about feminism that I don't think the left wants to be told, which is that the story around feminism doesn't need to just be about women choosing not to have families, to you know, throwing off the yoke of traditional expectations of things that, in fact, many of us choose. You know, divorce rates are going down, people are actually marrying more, and often the left doesn't actually preach what they practice. But she belies that point, and I think it's very frustrating for people.
Yeah, well said. Appreciate that perspective. Before we let you you both go, Sean, do you want to give us a preview of any columns you have coming up?
Yeah, I have a column running on Saturday in the National Post, Jamil, that speaks to some of the issues we talked about tonight. In particular, you know, I think one of the tensions within conservatism these days is whether we ought to lean into mainstream institutions or withdraw. Given the increasing hostility that those with conservative values and conservative lifestyle preferences face. And I think one of the powerful parts of Judge Barrett's testimony in the past couple of days is something that that Ginny alluded to, which is that as a conservative, an unapologetic, uncompromising conservative, she's managed to participate and ultimately excel in mainstream institutions, first at Notre Dame Law School, and now approaching appointment to the Supreme Court. I think it's a lesson to conservatives that we ought to lean in, you know, be humble but firm about our values and beliefs, and draw from the lesson of Judge Barrett that we can ultimately start to tilt mainstream institutions in a conservative direction.
Well, we look forward to reading the article. Thank you, Sean, and thank you, Ginny, for joining the show tonight. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Jamil.
Thanks, Jamil.
All right, that was Sean Speer, fellow in residence at the Public Policy Forum, and Ginny Roth, National Practice Lead in Government Relations at Crestview Strategy. You know, when we spend so much time thinking about the media and, you know, the way they fail us in giving us the truth and giving us a balanced narrative, or at least representing different sides. And I think Sean and Ginny highlighted that very well as it relates to Judge Barrett. And that's why it becomes even more frustrating when you see social media companies being so manipulative, right? Like if we can't get a balanced story, we can't get the truth from the newspapers or the TV stations, then where do we get it? You know, we look at social media and we hope you can get it there, but now Twitter and Facebook also want to censor people, and they also want to tell us what we can see and what we can share with one another. And it's just, it's really a wake-up call. I hope it's a wake-up call for everyone listening to this show. We've got to be vigilant, we've got to be critical, and we can't take anything for granted. We'll be back tomorrow night, tonight with Jamil Giovanni.